This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. One guest this week, a great one, Jeff Van Gundy, the longtime ESPN NBA analyst. He, along with Mark Jackson and Mike Green, will call the NBA Finals on ABC. Game one of the NBA Finals is Thursday, June 1st at 8:30 p.m. There are going to be some earlier start times for this NBA Finals, which I think is great news and very, very interesting. Jeff and I go through a ton of topics here, including the early start times. We get into the Nuggets a little bit and just sort of how national media looks at them. Get into Jeff's sort of broadcasting philosophy and just the fact that I think even he's surprised at how long he's done this. And finish up on talking a little bit about the WNBA. And the growth of that game. Jeff also gives you his analysis of Victor Wembanyama and what kind of impact he may be. So I think you're really going to enjoy this. Jeff Van Gundy is always a great guest. We go about 45 minutes or so. And without further ado, Jeff Van Gundy coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top, very pleased to be joined by this guest. He's been on this podcast before. Jeff Van Gundy joined ESPN in 2007 as an NBA analyst. I'll ask him about that. It's crazy to think that's when he joined. He serves as an analyst for the NBA Finals on ABC. Conference Finals, you just saw him. Obviously, regular season games, NBA postseason. Game one of the NBA Finals will be the Denver Nuggets versus, as we are taping this, either the Heat or the Celtics on Thursday, June 1st at 8:30 p.m. on ABC. Pleased to be joined by Jeff Van Gundy. Jeff, welcome to the Sports Media Podcast.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Jeff, here we go. We'll start here. Earlier start times for the NBA Finals. I mean, I know you're very detail-oriented. You're someone who likes to get to airports, whatever, 7 hours early. Are you going to be okay with the early start time now for the NBA Finals?
You know, it's interesting because they always go back and forth on this. 9 p.m. Eastern, 8:30, trying to find the right, you know, exact time for the audience. And it's always going to be hard because, particularly for the weekday games, the West Coast audience is going to be impacted. Maybe they're not there for the start of the game. They're not back from, you know, from work yet. But you don't want to lose out on the East Coast audience who, you know, goes to bed before the final game. So I think 8:30 is a really good time. I'd love to see them move up the Sunday games so that, you know, it's a more reasonable. I don't know if they've done that, if it's at 8. I think they once did it at 8 Eastern, but I'm not sure if that's what they're doing this year. So they're always trying to find the way to maximize the viewership. And I think 8:30 is a reasonable, logical time.
Yeah, no, I happen to agree with you. The you know, I will say, I think it's tough to be a television programmer because there are more people who live east of the Mississippi, so you have, that's a real thing, and like you have to factor that in. But you don't know who the teams are going to be in the NBA Finals, and you do want to cater to the local fans as well. You don't want to make it impossible. And then lastly, as you just mentioned earlier, like you do want to bring, you know, the NBA. The NBA's demos as a television product are really good. They're younger than most of the other sports. So you want at least to give the opportunity to younger people to see the end of the game, which makes a 9 o'clock, 9:05, 9:20 tip-off time tough. So there's not really a perfect time, but I think I'm going to be curious to see both the viewership number and more than that, maybe just like the sentiment, if people are more excited about a game ending at a little bit earlier time, the way we've seen. I don't know if you're a baseball fan, Jeff, but baseball fans have been, it's almost like a revelation for them to have all these earlier games now because of the rule changes.
Oh, I am fired up from a baseball perspective. And I love the innovation to speed the game up, all the hand-wringing that went into it about it's going to mess with people's routines. I think sometimes you forget that this is a business with consumers and it should be structured around what's best for the consumer. And baseball certainly hit a home run in their rule changes and game times. And I think we should be continually striving from the NBA perspective, how we can get it down to 2 hours. I know there's things that we can do to keep our game moving instead of going into 2 hours and 20 minutes, 2 hours and 5 minutes. I think it gets to be a little long.
What would you, I want to follow up on that. What are some of the things you think that can reduce the game time?
So my most radical one is eliminate free throws into the last 4 minutes. So if you get fouled on a shooting foul, you just get the points. You don't go to the line. You don't go to the line for technical free throws. They're just points. And then I would eliminate halftime. I think halftime is the biggest waste of time, or I'd reduce it to 5 minutes. Go in, go to the bathroom, come back out. This whole idea of what goes on at halftime, I think is so misunderstood. It's a lot of like, you know, either praising what just happened or correcting, but you could do that in 2 minutes out by the bench, an elongated timeout. So free throws would be my first one. Like I said, until the last 4 minutes, I don't think you want to take away the sure free throws throughout, you know, in the last 4 minutes of a game, but let's speed it up. The only person that likes free throws is the play-by-play announcer, because they can wax poetically some story. And also, Mike Green has a abnormal free throw, like he loves talking free throw shooting. But those are the only people. It's the extra point of the NBA. It serves no rational, reasonable purpose.
You may have lost James Harden a lot of money and some other people who've been at the free throw line. Let me ask you one thing about what you just said, because it's actually pretty fascinating. You know, obviously you were an accomplished coach, so you would know what goes on in halftime. The players don't need, like, what about the rest element? Is there value for the players to have 15 minutes of rest versus five?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I'm not a physiologist, but that'd be an interesting one. I know this, having to re-warm up, and it's a pet peeve of mine now. It used to be that, you know, you watch teams before games and how they warm up. And they warm up and they get into a sweat. And then you watch teams at halftime straggle out. Some don't come out and even do anything. And so they, and then you watch, you know, the European teams when you're in an Olympic competition, and they're sprinting at halftime. And they're, how they go about halftime makes more sense, that they're actually getting rewarmed up and so that they can start the second half warm, ready to go. Whereas American NBA teams, I think halftime does them a disservice. It may help in a rest, but they don't rewarm up. And we have these sports performance coaches, and I'm actually shocked that they haven't made it a priority to have the pregame and the halftime warm-up be more similar.
Interesting. I want to get to a couple broadcasting things. Next year will be your 17th season calling NBA basketball for ESPN. That must seem like just an insane number to you, that's your... You've now been a broadcaster nearly 20 years.
No, it catches up to you really quick. You know, what started out as a sort of like a way station because of some family things and kids and all that between coaching stops now has turned into this like secondary profession. And, you know, just really sometimes you have to just eternally grateful for opportunity. And Mike and Mark took me in that long ago and had the same boss in Tim Corrigan the whole time. And so, you know, you're surrounded by friends and you get to do the games with, you know, great, obviously they're great at their jobs, but for me, that didn't really matter as much as I needed a job and I needed it to be where I had flexibility and to, you know, like you said, 17 years later, say you're still doing it. And also you just know that, hey, it's hard in this profession to keep a job, and change is happens all the time, every sport. And so you can't be, you know, you have to be grateful for what you have at that moment, because it can change at any time. And at some point it will change for me. I'm just, like I said, Richard, just incredibly grateful for this opportunity.
2 years ago, you signed a multi-year contract agreement. ESPN put that out. Usually these deals are 3 years or 5 years. You're welcome to say it. You don't have to, obviously, what the contract length is. But I wonder, so how do you look at it now, just in terms of, like, approach? Like, I'm not trying to retire you, Jeff, but, like, are you contract by contract? Like, if you were 30 years old, I think you'd obviously look at it differently in terms of, I want to be in broadcasting in the next 30 years. So how do you approach broadcasting right now, given that you obviously have arguably the top job for what you do? You're at a network that has the NBA Finals, although I do want to get into what the media rights will ultimately be sort of heading forward. And then maybe you just have your own designs on just how long you want to do this. So how do you approach all this stuff now, just like contractually?
Yeah. So I'd have to check. I think I have a couple years left. So it's either one or two. I'm not sure exactly what it is. I think it's tied. When is the rights deal up? Because I think it's tied.
2024 would be the end of the end of the current ESPN turnaround.
So I think that's when my contract is up. But you also know that other people with contracts have been, you know, it can still change all, you know, before then. But I like it. I really like who I work with. I think that's, like, for me, when you're trying to tackle a second profession, that's as important as the what. It's the who you're doing it with. And the management's changed. Above Tim Corrigan, it's changed a lot, but he's never changed. He's been there the whole time. I think that's given me great stability. And I've also gotten great feedback from him and from Mike Breen, like, teaching me the business. So I've been fortunate in that way. I remember way back, Mike, I did a year at TNT with Marv Albert and Mike Fratello between the Knicks job and the Rockets job. And he told me two things that were vitally important. One, don't say great when it's just good. Make sure you're intentional about your language. And the second thing is, find somebody that will tell you the truth in broadcasting, because most people in broadcasting, it's great job, great job, great job, you're fired. They never tell you the truth. And as a coach, you're used to giving honest feedback and correction. So when you go into a new profession, which I did in broadcasting, you don't really know how it works, but both Tim and Mike have given me, you know, honest feedback. You know, Tim just last week was unhappy with something my tone of voice. He said it was far too sarcastic. And, you know, but that real feedback is truly helpful. And I think it allows you to try to keep getting as good as you can be.
So it's just for the audience knows the specifics. The NBA's deals with ESPN and Warner Brothers Discovery, which is Turner, are at the come up at the end of the 24-25. NBA season. The incumbents traditionally have a window where they can negotiate with the NBA before the package would go up to potential other bidders. Jeff, in your position as a broadcaster, do you ever like want to discuss like that with Tim Corrigan or Jimmy Pitaro, or do you intentionally sort of like separate, like, that's the business, let those guys deal with it, I'm only focused on the games? And the reason I ask you that is because the reality is, like, what happens with that decision absolutely impacts you and Mark and Mike. So it does impact your livelihood. At the same time, you're not going to be in the boardroom with Adam Silver negotiating this deal, right? So how do you look at
it? I think you just nailed it. I'm not really that clued in, as you could just hear earlier. I don't even know when the rights up. So I thought it was 2 years. I'd heard that. So
it is sort of in terms of the start of the season, you know, like the technically.
Right. So it absolutely impacts, and yet you have nothing, you have no control over it. So I think ESPN will stay in, you know, and Turner will too, but will there be additional people? I think that's what most people think, that there may be additional broadcasting. I hate saying partners, because partners, I hate that term partners, because what partner in your life do you pay all the money to? Like, that's not a partnership. That's like, you know, but anyway, the broadcast partners. And, you know, frankly, if it ended tomorrow, if they came in to me and told me, hey, we're not doing pro basketball anymore, or we are doing pro basketball without you, I gotta say, like, when you said 17 years, I came in the like playoffs of 1 year. I got fired from the Rockets and I came in like the same day doing a NBA game in San Antonio. So it's just been like incredible to provide this level of stability. And, you know, you have all this like ESPN roster, people getting let go. I tell you, it's like, I'm fine. I just really feel like the trauma for people who having to deal with upheaval, particularly as they get older in life. I mean, I really, really feel for them. And it's, you know, it's rough.
Now I appreciate that perspective, because you've had a lottery ticket broadcasting career. Like, it's the only word I would look at it. Like, these jobs are very few and far between, and you've had one. Not only have you had one, you've had one for a long time. So in that sense, I feel like, you know, the way to think about it is, it's just gravy, and as long, you know, ride the gravy as long as you can. But that's sort of where it comes down to. I want to. Actually, before we get to some, like, I ask you about the Nuggets. So in the Steve Rushen Sports Illustrated piece, which was really, really great on you and your brother Stan, there's a part in there like where I think maybe, I don't know if Stan's making fun of you or Rushen sort of is, but they're talking about how you love to see how excited you are to see celebrities at games. And so, like, you got excited when you saw Rihanna, Jennifer Garner. So I wanted to ask you, who is the most famous person to come up to you at an NBA game and just start talking about basketball?
Well, I love comedy, right? So I saw Bill Burr at a game, but I didn't get a chance to. I was going to run up in the stands at a timeout. He was up at a Laker game. I wanted to run up and say hello because I just find him hysterical. But Dave Chappelle stopped me after game 3 in LA. And I got to say, he wanted to talk basketball, and that was like, I could barely understand what he was saying because I was so flabbergasted that I was standing in front of him. And Denzel Washington, all these people know Mark, like, I don't know him, but everybody knows Mark. So they'll say hello to me. But like Denzel Washington, like, when you talk a level of greatness in a profession, you don't get better than that. So pretty fun too.
I love that. And that's what happens when you're doing games in LA. Things like that happen.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, the Nuggets. I want to ask you about the Nuggets, Jeff, because right now that's the one team obviously we know is in the NBA Finals. They're a fascinating team, and I think Michael Malone is absolutely correct when he says that, like, other teams get more interest in us. Everybody's focused on other teams. We're not focused on the Nuggets. The reality is, at least from my perspective, like, there is a there's sort of a financial aspect here, like producers and opinion show people and maybe places like The Athletic. Like, they're going to write about the Lakers and the Celtics and the Knicks because you can monetize that stuff. There's just a lot of fans of those teams. They're in big, big, big cities. That said, like, I get where Michael Malone, you know, I like the us against the world thing in a way because I think it probably works for the team. My perspective, Jeff, and I wanted to get yours, is no matter what happens, whether the Nuggets win or lose the NBA Finals, because they're in the NBA Finals, I think you will think of them differently as a franchise just after the fact. Because if they win, then they're a championship-winning franchise. If they don't win, well, they've now been in the NBA Finals, and they've had all this exposure for as many games as they end up playing. How do you see it? Because the Nuggets as an entity have become sort of part of the story this week.
Well, I think you're right in that it certainly is going to elevate their business, and the consumer is going to know more about them. You know, Jokic, everybody who studies NBA basketball understands how great he is, Murray as well. But there are a lot of casual fans, and they're not going to tune in. They don't have the NBA package. They're not tuning in, you know, on a daily basis to see, you know, Denver play. And I think when you get exposed in the playoffs and you get, you know, conference finals and then the finals where it's the largest audience and it's also only two teams are left, it's going to be a revelation for so many people. A, how good Denver is. B, how spectacular Jokic is. And C, they have one of those teams right now that could be together and go on a good, you know, 3-5 year run with continuity. So this is a special time for Nuggets basketball. And I listen, every coach uses every tool at their disposal to try to maximize their team's abilities, motivations. And so, you know, I worked with Michael Malone when I was at the Knicks and his dad for forever, and Brendan Malone. And so I am so happy for them. But the, like you said, The Athletic or whoever it may be, ESPN, whoever covers the games are going to go where the interest is. The writers don't drive interest. The writers write to where the interest is. So they're going to be a Lakers-centric, LeBron James, Steph Curry-centric coverage. That's just how it is.
Yep. I think you'd have good insight into this. Like, human scouting is always fascinating to me. And so while, like, I could sort of understand, even if it's sort of today, like, crazy, how someone like Giannis doesn't go number one, but let's say he goes, like, in the 20s. Like, all right, so he still is a first rounder. You missed him as number one, but he went there. Can you explain how someone like Jokic goes in the second round of the NBA draft? Like, it's one thing to miss, like, in the lottery. It's another thing to, like, not draft a guy who's a multiple-time MVP in the first round of his year. In terms of, like, scouting, that will end up being one of the most insane sort of scouting. I don't know if it's fair to say scouting misses, but do you know what I'm saying, Jeff? Like, if you went around in professional sports and looked at MVPs, the list of MVPs who are drafted in the second round in multiple sports is going to be infinitesimal. And this guy is.
Yeah. And, you know, you have Ginobili drafted 55, 58, something like that. And I think it goes to maybe our overseas scouting isn't nearly as extensive as it maybe should be. I also think you never can get into the mindset of a player. Like, when they become a pro, who's going to become and they're getting paid to do this as a job, who's going to become more motivated and who's going to become, you know, less motivated? And I think, again, Jokic has he always had great hands, great skill. I think everybody was worried about his level of conditioning, how his pick and roll defense would be as far as his ability to move. And I think what all that came back to was this guy is and has improved so dramatically from his first year to now. He has just gotten better and better. And it hasn't been his basic skills. Like he had always had great hands, great feel, could really pass. You know, he could score, but his defense has improved exponentially, particularly his pick and roll defense. His conditioning, he has gotten himself into top flight condition where maybe before he wasn't. And so you're right. You don't get second round MVPs. And this was a complete miss. And what's funny is Tim Connelly, who's now running Minnesota's basketball operation, he's the one that drafted him. And people, when they try to praise him for that pick, he said, "Are you kidding? I waited to the 41st pick or whatever it was. If I was such a genius, I would have picked him in the first round." And that's really true. And so, as you said, like you're trying to make these evaluations, and you see it through, particularly in the lottery. You know, every year you see unbelievable hits and then complete busts. And you know, people always try to say, well, that guy doesn't know how to evaluate, or it's just, man, it's crazy trying to, you know, picture 10 years down the road what a man's level of motivation will be. Will he still love the game or love the game even more, or will the game grind him down to where it's only a job?
Yeah, that's a great point. And human sky is tough. I live in Toronto. So we have two of these patron saint guys, and Fred VanVleet, who was not drafted, and Pascal Siakam, who went very, very low in the first round, and they obviously both became all-stars. In Pascal's case, you know, like a third-team all-NBA guy. And that's just, I'm so fascinated by that, just like why certain people make it and then why others who are drafted super high might not. All right, a couple more things here before I go. You had the fortune, and I imagine like pleasure of coaching a couple of like transcendent centers. So Patrick Ewing was under you for a little bit, and obviously Yao Ming in Houston. Have you seen Victor Wembanyama play, or whether either in person or on film? But I have to say, Jeff, just as someone who's a basketball fan, like, you know, I know the word like unicorn gets thrown around a lot, but like, I think it's legit with this guy. Like he plays in a game that is very revelatory to me just as a fan who watches. How do you see it?
So last year we were doing a preseason game in Las Vegas in October, and that same day Wembanyama's Metropolitan 92s were playing the G League Ignite in a game. It was in some arena right outside of Vegas, and I forget where, but so I went to see him live, and you know, incredibly impressive skills, work capacity in the game, just seemed like, you know, terrific. And yet I'm always concerned, you know, I think somebody on one of these shows said, if Wembanyama just becomes Kevin Durant or, you know, that ilk, like one of the all-time greats, it'll be a disappointment.
Well, that's an insane comment.
Right? Yeah, it's just crazy that I just hope that we can be somewhat realistic early on with his progress and allow him, like LeBron James, who came in maybe as hyped, I don't know. You know, he wasn't in the playoffs his first year. He had a very good rookie year, but it wasn't like, you know, he immediately turned around a bad Cleveland team and made him a great team. That took a process of a couple years. Just hope we afford Wembanyama that same amount of time to transition to a new country, a new team, and the best basketball player. And I am, with all these guys of extraordinary size. I coach Yao Ming and his career was marred by injury, being so big, that I do worry about how his body withstands the grind of 82 games, being 7'5". But skill-wise, intensity-wise, like, he does seem to be incredibly unique. And I just hope we all just give him the necessary time to acclimate to the NBA, and we don't over-evaluate each and every game where it may, you know, all these young people take so much of their social or their cues on how they're doing through social media. I just hope we're just a little bit kinder to him than we are to some people on social media, so he can just grow at a natural, normal rate as an NBA player.
Yeah, my faith in that is not very high. I think the social media will be horrible regarding him. That said, I do think he probably has an advantage in this case of not being from the U.S., maybe not being as into U.S. social media culture as much. You know what I mean? The language differences there may benefit him, where it's a little bit, it's at least one step removed, where if you're a kid, you know, born in the U.S. and you grow up on TikTok or you grow up on social media, very hard to avoid that if that's been your whole life.
You know, I was told this early, and this was pre-social media, but when I came into the NBA, if you don't let the praise define you, you won't allow the criticism to diminish you. And I think that was incredibly valuable to me. And I find it really challenging for young people on social media. I read every year where players, Jason Tatum is the most recent one, who says, I get off of Twitter in the playoffs so I don't have to listen to the noise. And I think it does have a truly negative impact on players, on how they feel about themselves, on like their team, what they need to do better. And so I think it's smart of players. But my question remains, if it's better in the playoffs to do, why do you do it at other times? Because it's not like it's a bastion of positivity. Like, and I think what people do is they look for the good stuff that's said about them as validation. Unfortunately, in those positive comments, there's probably many, many negative comments that, you know, wear on them. And I just think as an athlete, you know, you just have to think to yourself, like, if I'm willing to do this in the playoffs, what value does it bring to my life? Why should I be on it the other, you know, 9-10 months of the year? I've never been given a great reason why it helps.
Yeah, I mean, my only thought here, and again, you have kids who are under 25. It's very hard, I think, for people of that generation to get off when all their friends around them are on it. And so I think it would take, this is just my take, it would take a big discipline to be able to turn it off for 9 months, where maybe you can sort of turn it off for 2 months or 8 weeks and the discipline's a little better. Also, there's commercialization. You know, these guys can make money on pushing their brand.
Oh, that's true.
Brand,
yeah, the money part.
Yeah. If you want to be in, like, media, like, there's value for, like, Draymond. I'll just use Draymond Green, for example. Like, you want people to know that I have this podcast out. And if you have 2 million people following you on a social media platform, that's an incredible distribution. But I imagine you agree with me on this. Both of us did not grow up. We were not young when this stuff existed. I cannot be more thankful that when I was 15, 14, 16 years old, none of this stuff was around. I thank technology gods every day that I didn't have to deal with what a 16-year-old person has to deal with today.
I agree. I was talking athletes, but you can just be talking, you know, any child walking the streets of, you know, Toronto or Houston, where I live. Like, it's hard. It's a much harder existence and a much more critical It's every, like, and that's why I understand the money that can be made. And like you said, Draymond Green or, you know, JJ Redick is, you know, all over the place with, you know, he has like different platforms. I get it when it's doing something good for you. I just, the vitriol of comments and the negativity, I tell you, like, I don't know if this happens with you, but I used to always say this in New York when the coverage was, you know, up and down. All right, if a bad article was written about me, like they're going to fire me if I don't do X, Y, and Z, right? If I read it, I don't need it to you to bring it to me to discuss it further. If I haven't seen it and I've stayed away from it and then you bring it to me, my question is why? Why would you bring it? And that's what I think even with the social media, even if you try to get away from it, if you're an NBA player, someone in your group is going to say something like, can you believe what so-and-so said? I mean, that in itself puts doubt in your mind. And that's why I think who you surround yourself with is even more critical in this social media time, because you can totally see why adults get bogged down in the negativity of social media. Can you just imagine the pressure that like the negativity would bring to a young person whose, you know, brain is just forming? I agree with you. It's rough.
I'm with you. Yeah. No, I'm a native New Yorker. So I lived in New York during your time coaching the Knicks and purchased the Daily News and the New York Post. That would not do anything for your psyche to be reading those pages every day. Because even like, let's say even if you were on a run, it's not like there's going to be 20 like Van Gundy's a genius columns, maybe one. But then when things are going bad, that's multiple columns there. So yeah, your PR people should handle that, not you.
The best thing I ever did as far as that, Richard, was the really bad back pages. I cut out and framed and put them on my wall because that keeps your humility. Like when it says Van Gundy, you know, like they're making, you know, back up the van, you know, it's time to move on. You know, like all those.
For the New York Post, the van part was money. Van Grumpy,
yeah,
Van Gone. You could do anything with
it. Yeah, you really could. And they did. And they, you know, but that really was like when you would walk, I could walk into my office every day and see the back pages hung up because it was so, you know, like I said, it was humbling and you have to like try to make light of it because it, you know, and this is like right now in broadcasting, I've had people I've worked with that are on social media that really get down about, you know, what Joe Fan says on Twitter. And like, it's something I think it's called mentions. I might be on this, like, and they go and after games, like what fans say about them. And it really bums them out. And I just don't get it. Like if you're going on there for validation, you think somebody's actually going to say, hey, great job, ESPN. I really enjoyed listening to broadcaster X. Like, I'm sure that just doesn't happen very often.
Occasionally, but the algorithm is set, honestly, to sort of to promote and almost incite negativity. So you're absolutely right.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Here's the last thing I want to ask you, and then I'll get you out of here. You've always been somebody who's been, like myself, a women's basketball viewer and fan. You saw in your at your company, LSU, their win over Iowa drew nearly 10 million viewers, which was an incredible number for women's college basketball. The last week, we just saw Brittany Griner's regular season debut that set a record for ESPN for the most watched opening week WNBA game. As someone, Jeff, who like has sort of watched this evolution, to me, the WNBA has never been in a better position where it's terms of like athleticism, skill level, stardom. We got a couple super teams in the Aces and the Liberty, just in terms of like the former MVPs there. It feels like to me, particularly in basketball, like women's basketball is at a place, like it feels like a bit of a rocket ship. I don't know where the rocket ship's going to land, but it's only going up. And again, as someone who's watched the game and I know appreciate it, I just wanted to get your sense because at least when I watch the WNBA, the skill level's never been higher. It's a great league to watch.
Oh, it's jumped dramatically. The skill level, the athleticism, the coaching, all of it has been dramatically improved in the last decade. And you watch college, like you were mentioning before, that I think it's you know, going down levels to where the college game, you take it 25 years ago, watching some games, you could be a fan, but you weren't seeing, you know, great basketball all the time. You turn on a WNBA game or a high major college game right now, and it's big time basketball, big time athletes, and the intensity that it's played with is very good too. The WNBA, standpoint, the amount of rest that they get between games or the games that are played, I think allows that too. I also wonder all the time, would it be better? Is it better that the WNBA is competed in the summer months, or would it be better served to be a winter into spring? Or would the NBA playoffs,
NFL, that's the,
yeah, it, like,
you know, you get swallowed in that.
Yeah. Would they swallow them? I don't know, but I know that the game, and the players are at an incredible level. Some of the things that they can now do with the ball, I'm mesmerized when I watch, and it's so much better. The growth has been phenomenal, but the game has improved. So that's why to me that people want to watch more. It's just outstanding competition.
Do you think, I know there's been, I think you've done this a couple of times, but is there anything on your schedule this year where you might do a game as an analyst? Because I think you've done at least one or two that I remember watching you, I think.
I've never done a WNBA game. I did back in the lockout, one of the lockout years, I did a Connecticut at Baylor women's game. Awesome.
Yeah, that was it.
Awesome.
I remember
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so good. And frankly, a few years ago, they were talking about doing more, but the coverage is so good. And like Ryan Rucco, Rebecca Lowe,
Lobo.
Rebecca Lowe. I just screwed up my names. Holly Rowe and Rebecca Lobo. Like, they do such a phenomenal job with it and they are invested in it. Like, they're, like, that's what I love when you turn into a game. And I work with Ryan some on NBA games, and the way he talks about it on air is very similar to how he talks about it off air. I mean, he is absolutely fired up.
Yeah, they've helped those three, but obviously particular Holly and Rebecca. You put Pam Ward in there, Doris Burke before obviously she moved to the NBA. They really have helped grow the game.
Yes.
They're just not broadcasters. They've been almost like apostles of the game.
Which you need, and the coverage there is going to be a little bit different in that it's going to be more celebrating the game at all times,
yeah,
and celebrating the players and, being one with them, because without that level of enthusiasm that's out there for the WNBA right now would not be possible. So I agree with you. I think, and I think you're the one that mentioned it, or the first one I read mentioned it about moving the championship to prime time.
Yeah, Jeff. I have given your bosses this suggestion for a while. They finally took it, and I rewarded them with millions of dollars.
Yeah, no,
so like you're welcome.
Yeah, exactly. But sometimes it's amazing. You should just do it because that's what's best
for the sport
overall. Like, to give opportunity. Yeah, and so I hope the WNBA, and this is what I think is the next frontier. And I wish it was at a, like, not in the fall. It's just there's the finals when they play the playoffs. It's sort of just no matter when you place it right now in the year, there are problematic things.
College football, yeah. Major League Baseball at its core. The problem for the WNBA, and there's no solution, honestly, is the final. There's so much going on around the WNBA finals that it presents programming and scheduling issues for ESPN. And there's not a solution. There's not a great solution around it.
I always wondered if July, if they played it as like after the NFL all the way and their finals were
the summer.
In the summer, if that would not be better. I don't know if that's feasible from facilities and all that sort of standpoint. I have no idea. But I just don't like that their season, and it always is seemingly getting interrupted by a World Cup or a, next year will be the Olympics. And then, you know, it's just, I think sometimes it would be better as like a spring ending in the summer, but that's just me speculation.
No, I know what you're saying. And then it gets into the salaries. You know, there's a reason why the players play abroad because they can make more money as they, and they only have a short window, like all athletes. The good news is it's heading in the right direction. It's not perfect, but it's on an upward trend. A lot of money is being invested in it, and that's really where it's the road. You know, the rubber meets the road, and so I'm glad to just at least talk to you about it a little bit because I know that you were a prominent NBA coach who talked about women's basketball. That wasn't always the case. It's much more common now, though. And that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. And Toronto's got to get a team. You guys just didn't you have a great attendance at a
sold out in minutes. And the crowd of 19,000 plus was I've never seen more girls under the age of 18 at a Toronto pro event than I did for that. Keyword exhibition game,
right?
In Toronto, wasn't a regular season game. Like people went to see the Sky and the Lynx play an exhibition game in Toronto, and I think even the WNBA commissioner, I think, was honestly a little bit taken aback by like, wow, like this is maybe a better market than I thought. And you know this, Jeff, just from traveling, like if they can figure out the customs and private air part, then they can do it. It's the if you fly commercial, it gets a little tougher. It's like a competitive disadvantage, right? If you got to go through airports and all that stuff.
But if Toronto gets a team, they'll be milking that. They'll have the border patrol agents like we always thought. Change, like even when you would come in there, like in back to back, we were convinced sometimes that the border patrol agents were in on it because, you know, it took forever, like some nights. And it was like, you know, we came through there in the playoffs like a couple years when I was coaching the Knicks. And I swear to you, they must have inspected every bag like 10 times. And that's what you got to do. You got to get everybody involved from border patrol agents on to set the home court advantage.
They're like, Mr. Van Gundy, you have a parking ticket from 1986. We can't allow you to.
That's what they should have done. I'm sorry. Hey, Ewing, you're not allowed in. I'm not sure why, but you're just not allowed in. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. All right. The NBA Finals start June 1st. Nuggets versus somebody. Jeff Van Gundy will be on the air, of course, with Mike Breen and Mark Jackson. That's on ABC. You can catch Jeff throughout the finals. And then obviously next season. The NBA starts. Jeff, it's always great to catch up with you. I wish you nothing but the best of success. Travel safe. Get to the airport, please, 4 hours early if you have anywhere to go. I know you and Stan, it's important to you and Stan. And thanks for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
You got it. Take care, Richard. Bye.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Jeff Van Gundy. That was great. I really appreciate his time. If you like this kind of podcast, head to the archives. Had a couple this week, actually, or last week, I should say. Post LeBron James content universe. What does that mean with Sam Amick? WNBA's record viewership start with LaChina Robinson. Had Rolling Stone chief critic Alan Sepinwall on how he does his amazing Succession reviews, as well as a discussion on that show in the Star Wars universe. Endeavor president CEO Mark Shapiro. Peter King was on this podcast to talk about the NFL schedule. Daniel Jeremiah talking about what it's like to cover the NFL draft. There should be things in there that that you appreciate. I want to thank Patrick Antonetti for all his hard work. Thanks, everybody at Canes 13 and Odyssey for their support. Thank you for listening. We'll see you soon.